Hello and welcome to the Contemplations of the Lotus Eaters. This is episode 19 and we'll be talking about Taoism, which is a philosophy that Josh is going to tell us all about. So I'm here with Josh, who's the expert now. So take it away, Josh.
I wouldn't quite call myself an expert, but it's something that I quite enjoy looking into, and I think there's a lot that can be gained. And I think people who are particularly interested in philosophy quite often look at the Western sphere and they don't look at the East, and I think there are some things that can be gained. And also I'm going to talk about some of the stuff that I don't necessarily think is as wise as it is made out to be as well. So what is the Tao or the Tao? It can be translated to mean the way, the route, or the road, in kind of a more loose way, and in a more colloquial way it can mean a doctrine or a principle. And you're going to come across two different kind of competing spellings of it. Sometimes it'll be Tao with a T or Tao with a D. And this is just from the translation after the kind of pinyin, I think it's called, which kind of romanized Chinese characters. Right. It was originally Tao and it was translated to Tao. Even though it sounds more like Tao, it's perhaps more accurate to spell it Tao, which is a bit confusing. And that's why a lot of the kind of academic documents call it Tao, but it's also known as Tao. But for kind of the purposes of this, I'm going to pronounce it Tao, but spell it Tao.
Okay.
Just to be confusing.
Your terms are acceptable.
I'm glad you approve. So Chinese language doesn't actually have a term for kind of the lay people adhering to a principle or doctrine. So the term Taoism is like a Western thing, a Western invention, to say, you know, the ism at the end is like, I am a follower of, you know, Buddhism or something like that. And the actual translation of Tao in the context of person means something like Tao Shi, or the master of the Tao, which is someone who is like a professional representative of this belief, like a priest or some kind of monk. And yeah, as I said, followers of Taoism, which the term Taoism implies, is a Western imposition, and it's kind of viewed in China, at the very least, as just one part of a larger body of Chinese religion. So it's like saying in, say, a Western equivalent, a Christian just follows this one principle. It seems like strange because it's part of a much wider whole.
So it wouldn't be an equivalent of, let's say, Protestants or like the Amish or something like
that?
No. It wouldn't be the same because the idea is that there is this one whole that is kind of philosophy, a religion, something to that effect. And then you only pick one part, or Taoism is only one part of it. That is not like a specific doctrine that would not be compatible with the others, but is just one selection from it. But it's not the complete picture.
Yeah. And I think from this kind of perspective, there's lots of interesting philosophical things that you can draw from it. And I've tried to keep it away from the spiritual side of it because it's a very old religion, and or philosophy, should I say, not religion, that kind of speculates on things that kind of seem a little bit ridiculous in some cases. Like, and there are also lots of competing interpretations throughout the ages as well. So some people believe one thing, some people believed another, and I just want to look at the core beliefs and kind of have an investigation of those, should I say.
So you would say that it's a philosophy, not a religion, because it doesn't have a god, a deity that it would put at the center of it, right?
Well, there's kind of the understanding that there is a way that governs all things, but that can be a philosophical thing, can't it? It doesn't necessarily have to be. It's more like a path, or there is, it's
kind not of like anthropomorphized.
No, it's more focusing on how a human being interfaces with the world,
right?
And that's what it's focusing on, more or less. It's not necessarily trying to say, this is the order of the heavens or such. That seems to come from other, or other kind of Chinese philosophies or religions, and also in later developments, but in its kind of original form, which I'm looking at today, it's more philosophical in nature.
So that kind of ties into what you said before, that it's not a complete view of the world, it's kind of one section of it in that thinking, and it's the non-religious part of it. So there is religion in the whole, it might be religion in the whole, but it's not necessarily in Taoism itself.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So I think what might be useful for a frame of reference is think of kind of Stoicism in the West, and that's kind of a good allegory, both in kind of the sort of time that it was developed and also in the kind of perspectives that it brought about. Like, it, Stoicism was kind of rooted in kind of the pantheon of both Rome and Greece, although, you know, you can read it, not believe in the Greek or Roman gods, and it's still just as beneficial.
And if you want to know more about it, we have a book club on the page, lotusheaters.com, which is about Marcus Aurelius and meditations, which we put out a couple of months ago. So go check it out after we've done here.
So I think it'd be worthwhile to move on to where we actually know about Taoism. And that comes from its two main texts. Although, to be fair, there is some elements of Taoism that can be traced back to kind of the folk religions of China in prehistory. So it's kind of something that was formalized almost from a informal development or understanding of the way the world was at the time. But nevertheless, the individual Lao Tzu is regarded as one of the founders of Taoism, and he is supposedly the author of the Tao Te Ching, or Tao Te Ching, I don't know how you pronounce it, although we don't actually know whether he actually exists or not. So it's kind of like Homer in the Iliad, in that we have this book that's attributed to him, but it could be a development of, you know, multiple people and just put under a single person's name.
Right, right.
So, although this Lao Tzu figure is kind of hailed as one of the founders of this philosophical perspective, it may not actually be a person or not. So, it's dated to the 4th century BC, so it's pretty ancient as far as documents go. And the book mainly focuses upon the Tao and how this can be expressed in virtue. And it focuses on cultivating virtues in kind of the Aristotelian sense. So I'm going to continue to use kind of Western allegories here with Stoicism, because there is, to some extent, similar things flowing through both.
No, I think it's good because we need some kind of frame of reference, right, to compare, something to compare it to. So it's kind of useful, I think.
So the actual philosophy itself focuses on things such as naturalness, known as Ziran, and non-action, known as Wu Wei. And it seems to, at least historians seem to believe, that it's been developed on over the years, and it's kind of a thing similar to the Bible, where there are some passages that may be older than others, but in its current form, it's split into 81 very short chapters of passages, each containing a verse, which is meant to communicate a different point about wisdom, although I found that many were just making the same point in a different way. There is also another foundational text called the Zhuangzi by Master Zhuang, or I'm not entirely sure I'm pronouncing that right either.
Oh, we can put it on the screen.
And I'm not going to focus on that one today because it's quite a long book, but supposedly it's more kind of story-like, and it has humour and philosophy, and it's just more of a cultural book, I imagine, if that makes any sense. So I'd like to read a few of the chapters from the Tao Te Ching, rather than just tell you what they believe. I think it's better to read from one of the seminal texts, just so you can kind of see for yourself what the kind of teachings are. So here I take from chapter 3, and it says, "By not adoring the worthy, people will not fall into dispute. By not valuing the hard-to-get objects, people will not become robbers. By not seeing desires of lust, one's heart will not be confused. Therefore, the governing of the saint is to empty one's mind, substantiate one's virtue, weaken one's worldly ambition and strengthen one's essence. He lets the people to be innocent of worldly knowledge and desires and keeps the clever ones from making trouble with their wits. Acts naturally without desire, then everything will be accomplished in its natural order.
So that sounds a little bit like Stoicism in some parts.
Yeah.
Saying that you need to strengthen yourself, you need to focus on your own values and virtues, mm-hmm. and not focus too much on the outside world. And how the outside world is going to look is going to be determined by your values and who you are as a person and your perception of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one part of it, I think. And the other part, which is not so much Stoic, is that you should ignore to a certain extent the outside world. You mm-hmm. should not be moved by it. It should kind of flow by you, and you should be focused on something else. You should be kind of amenable to it in some ways.
Yeah.
But you should not dwell on it.
Yeah, and I think this is the principle of Wu Wei, which we'll get onto later. But I particularly like this look at kind of removing yourself or detaching yourself from kind of worldly desires in a way, because it seems to me that certainly as a psychologist, that desires seem to stem not based on things that you actually need, but it's more about social status, and you determine what is desirable based on who has what and where, and you'll never be satisfied if you think about desire in this way, because no matter how high you climb up the hierarchy, there will always be at least one person, unless you are the very top, in which case you're going to be so consumed by other people rising above you that there's yep. almost no joy in it in the first place.
So if you adopt this kind of framework, wherever you are in the hierarchy, it doesn't matter, you're still going to be miserable.
That's one way of looking at it, but it's also that desire isn't necessarily, although it can motivate you to do supposedly good things, it is not necessarily a virtuous thing to have desire for material things. And mm-hmm. it's talking about controlling your desires and limiting it so it is not all consuming.
So when desire is mentioned here, is it just about material things, or is it also about kind of about anything worldly, about anything not spiritual but not necessarily material either?
I think it certainly is that to some extent, but although some of the vagueness may come from just simply the fact it's, you know, 6,000 years old mm-hmm. and translated into modern English, I think some things may get lost, mm-hmm. but there seems to be speaking of things getting lost, I lost the point I was making there. Sorry, what was it?
So whether it's about desire for material things or desire for any worldly thing, not just mm-hmm. spiritual things, like what is to be avoided?
I think it sees desires as kind of ironically undesirable, in that they lead people to say be confused, in the fact that it says by not seeing the desires of lust, one's heart will not be confused,
mm-hmm.
and it's saying that perhaps you need to be at least more aware of your desires and perhaps limiting them and holding them back. It doesn't necessarily say
what kind.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's more about trying to prove that desire in and of itself is not a virtuous thing.
Okay.
And moving on to chapter 8, and just to kind of backtrack, I've been picking these out just based on whether I thought they were interesting. There's no real method here. I haven't picked out necessarily the most significant ones, just the ones I thought would be most interesting to talk about. So, chapter 8. A person of great virtue is like the flowing water. Water beneath all things and contends not with them. It puts itself in a place that no one wishes to be, and thus is closest to the Tao. A virtuous person is like water, which adapts itself to the perfect place. His mind is like the deep water that is calm and peaceful. His heart is kind like water that benefits all. His words are sincere like the constant flow of water. His governing is natural without desire, which is like the softness of water that penetrates through hard rock. His work is of talent like the free flow of water. His movement is of right timing like water that flows smoothly. A virtuous person never forces his way and hence will not make faults.
So that's kind of similar to some of the points in the previous one, right? Mm-hmm. Saying that you need to conform to what's happening around you, but not conform in the way that you should submit, but you should make your peace with it.
Yeah, and it's Taoism makes a lot of references to water, mm-hmm. and it sees a lot of virtue in water, which is an unusual thing.
Yeah.
But it's more of an allegory. It's not like they were like the Mongols, where they were, if you perhaps washed your clothes in water, then you would be put to death. It's nothing like that. In fact, they were against the death penalty, a lot of the Taoists.
So the water references are more likely to be something that could be closer to how you tell stories
mm-hmm.
6,000 years ago, rather. And that's why it might seem a bit foreign now, because that's not how you really tell stories in the present. You don't compare yourself to water. That's a bit weird.
It is, yeah. But I think it would be something that would be familiar to everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think they've deliberately picked something here that communicates their point quite clearly, because everyone would know
fair enough
what water is like, especially in China. And
I mean, if you compare yourself to the telegraph, right? Well, that's not exactly something that's going to last forever, or that future generations will understand, right?
I couldn't ever see like philosophical poetry just talking about the telegraph newspaper.
There
just,
are very artistic people out there. Yeah. Everything's possible.
I would say if they
aim for the stars.
I do not approve of this. But I do like the emphasis here on adaptability mm-hmm. and being able to be in the perfect place and be calm and peaceful. It's saying that it's almost talking about competence here, isn't it? It's saying that you're competent no matter what situation you're placed in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's saying that the water wants to occupy the places where other people do not. And it's saying that being able to do things that other people may not want to do, there is a certain amount of virtue in that.
That is kind of an interesting point that which you just mentioned. Yeah, it puts itself in a place that no one wishes to be, and thus is closest to Tao. That's quite weird for me, because it's not just something to be adaptable, to be resilient or something like that. It's also to be actively against something that is usually striven for, right? And mm-hmm. so I don't know how to interpret that. Is it just contrarianism to some extent, or is it something that is deeper than that?
I think there's a certain amount of you're willing to put a burden on yourself that other people may not, and I think it's relating a little bit to competence in a way, as with some of the other points, in that if you put yourself in a place where other people do not want to be willingly, then it's almost like an act of showing your ability to get yourself out again, perhaps. It's like a way of testing yourself, because if no one wants to be there, it can't be somewhere pleasant. But if you willingly go towards it, that's it. Can you see that it is kind of pointing towards this virtue here, that someone will willingly do something that other people will not?
So you're showing strength.
Yeah, in a way, but it's kind of saying it in a roundabout way and using these kind of water analogies. I suppose it's difficult to. Well, it also says with the analogies of with water, it can break stone. I think that was in the previous one, wasn't mm-hmm. it? And it's talking about how the adaptability and water's ability to move around things is kind of very counter to the Western view of tackling things head on, isn't it? It's adapting around
waterboarding.
That's, in a sense, where a Taoist would venerate water, a Westerner would use water to get information from someone.
So is it when that specific line is about showing strength and this kind of resolve, is it also something about sacrifice, or is sacrifice not something that is a concept that is close to Taoism? Because if it's about, if part of it is about going somewhere where other people don't want to go, maybe it's somewhere necessary where someone has to go, so you take it on yourself because you want to spare others the suffering, because you're willing to bear the burden, right?
It doesn't necessarily kind of see virtue in suffering in and of itself, but it certainly places emphasis on having few possessions and few worldly desires. So there's some degree of nobility in not having very much, but I wouldn't say it would necessarily be suffering, because if you're suffering, then you're not going to be close to the Tao, because you must have done something wrong to be in this position.
Right. I meant specifically sacrifices of yourself for others, right?
So, okay.
So whether that's something that is valued, or that is a good goal, or something valued to strive towards, or quality to have.
I would say that it would certainly be more towards that than perhaps the opposite, in that one should not place their own desires above perhaps those of other people, and things like that. And certainly the kind of aestheticism of lots of Taoist practitioners seems to show that there was, I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit here, but there was a kind of institution set up under, in kind of the Three Kingdoms period of China, known as the Five Pecks of Rice. And to be able to join the order of Taoism, you just needed to bring that quantity of rice, and which is where they got their name. A peck is like like a sack, I think. So you just brought some rice. It's kind of akin to what we see Buddhist monks later on in time doing, where they would go to a retreat with nothing but their clothes and some rice, and just go there to think about things and chill out a bit. No, I don't think they were doing that, but it shows that they were kind of minimalists in both philosophy and in practice, if that makes any sense.
I mean, you said that part of it was, well, we saw that part of it was of battling against desires and trying to minimize the effect that desires have on you as a person, right? And so that kind of leads you towards something like that, leads you towards voluntary poverty, or something that, where you don't necessarily need many material things, you don't need physical comforts, because that's not among the values that you want to have, because those are worldly desires.
That's more or less it, I think. So moving on to chapter 22, I jumped ahead a little bit here. A man of great virtue is one who follows the natural way of the Tao. This Tao is vague and intangible, yet in the vague and void there is an image, there is a substance. Within the profoundly intangible there is essence. This essence is genuine. In it lies a great faith. Since the beginning of the world, the Tao has been in existence. Only through it that one can understand the origin of all beings. How do I know that this is true essence? It is through the natural way.
That sounds a bit weird.
Yeah, and this is, I picked this up because it's the closest sounding to kind of religiousness that I could find here. And it's just trying to say that the Tao is an idea, it's a perspective, but it's trying to link it to naturalness, and it's saying that this is something that has come about from nature itself. In living harmoniously with nature, that is where Taoism comes from. And it's not necessarily saying it's always existed in the kind of spiritual of a worldly sense, but it's saying that it's almost like the laws of nature,
right?
But before that actually existed.
I mean, that makes sense, the laws of nature side of things. That's what I saw in it as well. But at the same time, I'm a bit wary of this type of speak, because what you had in the beginning is like, okay, it's nothing, but in the nothing there's something, you know. It's not, it's something intangible, but you can see something in it. No, it's kind of, I don't like that style.
It does sound a little bit like new age stuff, doesn't it? It's like, if you, I can feel the energy and there is essence, and it just sounds a little bit gibberishy. Yeah.
But I mean, if there's something in there, just say it, you know. Don't say there's nothing before you say there's something. Like, if there's something, that doesn't mean, that means there's not nothing, right? So, like, what is this? I'm just being really autistic about this. But
it could just be a case of the translation has made it a bit strange. And there are certainly concepts and ideas in the Chinese language in the modern day that are difficult to translate to modern English. And if that's the case, then going back, you know, 6,000 years, or, well, maybe even further for all we know, it may just not be able to translate well. And I think perhaps I can kind of understand what it's getting at, but it's one of those things where it's one of the more questionable things, where it's trying to relate itself to nature, and kind of this approach has risen up from nature, but there's a lot of kind of additional stuff that doesn't help to reinforce that point.
I mean, even though I'm a bit... Yeah, as I said, it doesn't sound good to me. It's something that I can understand it when I look at it charitably, like what it wants to say, right? Is that you can look around you, and especially if like civilization is not that advanced as today, it's like 6,000 years ago, you're in a very different environment. You might be more surrounded by nature and natural things, and it might look to you like everywhere's just chaos, and nothing is the way it's supposed to be, and everything's unpredictable. But what it's saying is there is an order to it. If you look carefully, you can see the order, and you will be able to kind of see what the world is about, see that kind of matrix behind that.
I think they might not use the word order. That might be a bit too strong, but I don't know. They might have actually used that word explicitly, and no, I just can't remember.
But there's just going to be this translation.
Yeah, but it's more that there is a way or an approach to the way things are that cannot be changed, almost.
Yep.
And I think that's what they're getting
at. Like what I meant, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like the translation of Dao, as you said in the beginning, is something like a way or... Yeah, something like that, but not specific, not precisely. It can be a little bit different, right? So it can be translated as a purpose or a striving or like these types of things. And I think order is something like that, like a natural order, right? Here you have the natural way. That's how it's translated here. But so that's kind of what I meant more specifically, I think.
I think we do think of things in a natural order sense, but that nature is always in a point of flux. There is no point of equilibrium. There's always change, and we kind of saw this. I'd know a decent amount about kind of the naturalist research in kind of the 70s, where they were looking at ecosystems, and they believed that there was some kind of stability to everything, but actually the populations of animals and which ones were succeeding and which ones weren't was always changing. There was never a stable point which it would revert to. So I think way would almost be more accurate than order in that sense. And I know I'm kind of belaboring that point a little bit, but I think that it's surprising that you can find a better description of nature here than you can in, say, a naturalist's textbook from the 1960s. And I thought that was quite interesting, at least to me. And I'm going to read chapter 24 in just a second, but I've already horse throat. Okay. He who raises himself on tiptoes cannot stand firm. He who walks with strides cannot travel far. He who is self-opinionated shall not be enlightened. He who is prejudiced shall not be recognized. He who brags about himself shall not receive credit. He who is arrogant shall not make improvements. In the view of the Tao, or the Dao, sorry, people who are self-centered are like the surplus food and redundant actions in everyday life. There's a bit of a weird translation there, right? All things disgust them. Therefore, a person of the Tao will not conduct himself in such a manner.
It's like, I like the... I agree that it's probably something that is the fault of the translation, or the kind of feature of the translation, but that that part where it says people who are self-centered are like the surplus food and redundant actions in everyday life, it's just like human trash, you know? That's really dismissive.
I don't know why they're so kind of scornful towards surplus food. Maybe they were proto-communists.
No. It's something that you don't need, right? It's something that you desire, right? So it's something not that you shouldn't want, because it's something more than
what you need.
More than biology dictates, and therefore that is part of desires.
But here it seems to be talking about carrying yourself genuinely. Yeah. That seems to be what I'm gathering here. Like standing on tiptoes, cannot stand firm, with strides, which I imagine would be kind of walking with bigger steps than you would naturally have, self-opinionated, prejudiced, brags. It's all about status and elevating yourself to a position which is not sustainable.
Yep, yeah. It's about being a quality person kind of inside and not being too... kind of fostering the virtues inside of you and not trying to just project outwards just how virtuous you are.
Yeah. A virtuous person doesn't go around voicing it, I think, is the how you can summarize this passage. But that seems relatively intuitive to most people in the modern day. I think that's not necessarily anything too profound, I would imagine.
It's like if a king says, I'm a king, they're not a king.
Yeah, it's the kind of like that great scene from Game of Thrones. I know it originated from before then, but I'll forever associate with it with that. So jumping all the way to chapter 77, I haven't read the whole thing, so I kind of skim read stuff, so there might be some great passages in there that I've missed out, so I've just kind of picked out some of the best from the start and the end, just so if people are interested, at least the middle will be a surprise.
No, this is good. This is a sneak peek. And so if people are interested, they know that there will be a lot of interesting stuff that we haven't covered.
It's not necessarily a particularly long book either, and I certainly intend to pick it up eventually and give it a read, because although it's kind of one of those things where in the modern day, a lot of it's not necessarily revelatory. In having these things written down and being able to focus on them, it's almost like a way of kind of looking at concepts that you might not otherwise think about.
Yeah. I mean, it helps often seeing things written in front of you rather than just having them at the back of your mind somewhere as common knowledge, but not necessarily something that you relate to quite often.
And I think some of the intentions of these chapters themselves was that people would learn them by reading them repeatedly and then contemplate these chapters and think about, so they're more about being reflected upon than just to be strictly adhered to and taken at their word. They're more like topics for meditation almost, because of course meditation, it has existed in the East for as long as we have documented history. So it may well be that these were just things that were the topics of meditation. Maybe they would even recite them to themselves while they were meditating. But nevertheless, chapter 77, the Tao of nature is like a stretching of a bow. When the stretch is too high, it needs to be pressed down. When the stretch is too low, it needs to be raised high. The excess will be reduced. The deficient will be replenished. The Tao of nature is to reduce the excessive and to replenish the insufficient. The Tao of man, however, is otherwise. It takes from the needy to serve those who already have a surplus. Who can spare one surplus to serve the world? A person of the Tao. Thus, a saint acts without holding on to achievements.
So this is kind of an interesting passage because I think it's partly going to be the translation again, but it doesn't really make sense to me. The Tao of Man is that it takes from the needy to serve the those who already have a surplus. And then a person of Tao is the one who can who's going to do the reverse. So I don't understand how both things can be the Tao at the same time.
I think what it's trying to suggest is that if man were left to their own kind of devices without the true way of the Tao, then this order would kind of take place where the needy have to serve those who already have a surplus. And that's kind of something that makes sense to me, at least to some extent, in that it, particularly in kind of historic terms, with kind of feudalism, where there would be a person who would govern over an area and they would take things from the people around them, even though they were already prosperous, like a tax, for example, or they would take a certain amount of food for protection or something along those lines, even though they did not need it. And it's trying to suggest that this isn't necessarily something that is the right way, even though it arises naturally.
And so maybe this is the wrong interpretation of this part, but let me know whether it is or not.
There is, I don't think there's any right or wrong here. But.
No, but I'm seeing the Tao of nature, right? That's the one term that is used here.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Tao of man is the other one that's used. Mm-hmm. And it kind of contrasts these two. It says the Tao of nature is to kind of equalize stuff and reduce excesses and supplant the deficiencies. And then it says that the Tao of man is otherwise. And then it says a person of Tao will do the things that the Tao of nature does. So maybe what it means is that there's these two Taos.
Mm-hmm.
One of them pertains to the man and one of them pertains to the nature.
Mm-hmm.
And man, even though his kind of what he's about is the Tao of man, what he should strive towards is the Tao of nature.
Mm-hmm. But don't forget that Tao only represents like the way or the path, and in this sense it may be used just purely as a linguistic thing rather than to represent the overarching philosophy of the Tao in the Tao of man.
So this could be more akin to the desires part above, right? Saying, okay, people naturally have desires and they tend to indulge in those desires. And so what you need to do is overcome that natural way that people have to become more like nature, because nature is governed not by desires, but by these laws of nature that are kind of perennial.
That sounds more or less like my interpretation of it, yeah.
Okay.
And I also like that it's kind of making reference to, with the analogy with the bow here, it's kind of talking about a point of equilibrium where things that are natural kind of come back into balance eventually, in the stretching of the bow, that's that kind of side of things, in that there is a pressure for it to return to the natural resting point, maybe.
Nature is healing.
Reminds me of that picture where with the all the mountain goats in a skate park in the lockdowns, it's like nature is healing.
Exactly. How the, I don't know, in California somewhere, right? They wanted people to stay inside and not go outside. And there was a beach, and on the beach there was a skate park. And they just filled the skate park with sand just so that people couldn't go there outside during lockdown.
That's awful.
Yeah.
That must have been so difficult to get rid of as well. Right. Oh, I missed off two lines of the last thing. This could change everything. It just says, he accomplishes but not claims for credit. He has no desire to distinguish himself. But so that's just
that's
repeating.
The person of Tao.
What was that, sorry?
It says,
Yes.
Who can spare one surplus to serve the world? A person of Tao. Thus, a saint's act without holding on to the achievements he accomplishes, but not claim for credit. He has no desire to distinguish himself. Just talking about that person of Tao, who's kind of aligned with nature and does not indulge in what the way of people is, which is his desire.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of reinforcing the point that we were talking about earlier, really. So, chapter 78 is as follows. There is nothing in this world that is softer and meeker than water. Even those that can conquer strong and hard are still not superior than water. Nothing can substitute it. Hence, what is soft can overcome the strong. What is gentle can overcome strength. This is known by the world.
I just degenerated too bad. Whenever there's water mentioned here, I'm just replacing it in my head with bread. Nothing in this world is softer and meeker than bread. Anyway, go on.
Enough about our weird cult of bread that has developed. The thing here is kind of reinforcing that adaptability and the virtues of water yet again.
Yep.
In talking about it being the most desirable state for a human being to emulate, almost, in that it's adaptable, but in its adaptability, that is where its strength arises from. In that, even, you know, like the previous chapter where it talks about it overcoming, not the previous one, but one prior, it overcomes the strength of stone simply by continually wearing it down.
Right. So it's about being adaptable to the extent where you can overcome everything, just because if something looks like an obstacle, you can just, if there's a wall of stones or something, you can just go through it because there's holes in it. And so if you adapt yourself to the holes and don't focus on the stones, then you're just going to go through.
That's more or less it, I think. And I think it's just...
adapt, overcome. Yeah.
Well, Bear Grylls was the original Taoist. So, another famous kind of verse, which is the final one I'm going to read out, is superior virtue has no intention to be virtuous and thus is virtue. Inferior virtue cannot let go of virtuosity and thus is not virtue.
The same as the king.
It is similar, I think, in that true virtue just is. It does not desire to be that sort of thing, isn't it?
It doesn't brag about itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's virtuous without needing to be pointed out as virtuous.
And that, I think that's relatively self-explanatory, that a virtuous person doesn't go around saying that they're virtuous, funnily enough.
It's kind of funny because there is an element of humility there, right? Which is a very Christian thing to kind of resist pride. Pride is the cardinal sin, right? And so to kind of be kind of polite and silent and like be in the background and not go out of kind of your comfort zone too much. Not in that way that the last comment was not exactly correct, but just not to stick your head out and not to be too abrasive, I guess.
Yeah, I can certainly see that. I think it's more for, it's not necessarily an outwardly focused thing though. It's for the benefit of the individual, and I think a lot of these passages are about the development of an individual. It's very it's part of the reason why it fell out of favor in communist China, is because it focuses on individualism and the individual. Unlike, say, Confucianism, which relates to how people relate to their relatives and the respect they have for their religious practices and things like that. And although they are viewed kind of as complementary belief systems, they can't be more different in their outlook on the world externally.
Mm-hmm. And so the focus is different. It's not, it's on yourself and on improving yourself.
Absolutely. Yep. So I'd like to move on to some of the principles that we've kind of talked about in a bit of a more formal way. So to kind of summarize some of the main principles of Taoism, it's kind of things being natural, being somewhat spontaneous, simple, being detached from desires, and most importantly, one which they emphasize quite a lot, is the principle of Wu Wei, which is also my favorite, and I'm going to get onto that one now.
Okay.
So Wu Wei is kind of the most important principle, and Wei refers to any intentional or deliberate action, and Wu kind of carries the meaning of there is no or lacking without. So you could say there is no deliberate action, or without deliberate action, or without intentional action.
So what does it mean? Does it mean that there's no such thing as a deliberate action, or there is nothing without deliberate action?
It's kind of looking at actions as being somewhat effortless. I think the most accurate translation that many scholars agree on is not to force anything.
Right.
It means to
go with the flow.
Yeah, it's quite a fitting analogy considering all of the water analogies that they make. And it certainly is along that vein in that you kind of find that it is better to do nothing than to force something. That would be something that a Taoist might suggest, and that there is also a kind of Taoist view that competition is its own form of cooperation. So if you look at the natural world, it doesn't seem like there's any harmony there. But if you look at how perhaps how animals depend on one another, although it may seem in a deer's interest to not have a predator prey on it, so maybe in the case of China, tiger, but the tiger keeps the deer population down, and in doing so it allows there to be more resources for the deer that exist, and therefore having the competition helps everything. And it's kind of that sort of principle, although they may not have explicitly looked at it in such a way. I felt like an analogy to nature might be appropriate for this kind of thing.
I'm just kind of connecting it in my head with our conversation about competition last week, right? Because like it's very far-fetched, but it's something that could be translated to similar arguments or similar values in economics and regulation and politics and things like that, right? So we did contemplations about that last week, so check that out as well.
Yeah, and funnily enough, when I was actually writing up the notes, I did think of that, like, it reminds me of our conversation where we were talking about regulations and stuff like that, and how competition is its own form of regulation, and it's kind of what it's arguing in a way.
Yep.
And the philosopher and broadcaster Alan Watts explains the principle of Wu Wei quite well, I feel. He says, Wu Wei is the art of sailing rather than the art of rowing.
Okay. So you use the natural kind of tools that that there are around you to go in the direction where your surrounding pushes you towards.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
And the kind of Western view would be that of rowing. And it's not necessarily saying, don't go anywhere at all. Like the principle of Wu Wei quite often is translated as just do nothing, and it's not necessarily saying that. It's not saying just be a slacker and you are at one with the Tao. It reminds me of the film The Big Lebowski, which is a great comedy film, by the way, one of my favourites. But in that film, though, they do paint him as this kind of almost religious figure. By just doing nothing but being really tranquil about it. But it's not necessarily that. That's just a comedic interpretation. And to move on to another one of the principles is that of Ziran, which I believe is the naturalness one, which kind of looks at things from the perspective of there is a primordial state to all things, if that makes any sense. It's kind of what we touched on earlier, that there is some kind of there are laws of nature that govern things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite often associated with spontaneity and creativity in the kind of Taoist practices, if that makes sense, how kind of the natural order of things can be associated with spontaneousness and creativity, because surely, like, if there is a natural order, it's somewhat stratified, and therefore how can there be creativity and spontaneousness? But I suppose if the order is constant change, then that might make sense.
Yeah, I mean, sure, spontaneity, yes, but creativity is a weird one, I feel.
It's because attributing, like, intention to it, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's like purposeful action, right? Mm-hmm. It's something that you feel like could be contradicting the previous point, saying you should not force something, whereas creativity would be often defined as something that is forceful against the trend, right?
Mm-hmm.
To do something that is original, to do something that is not popular, right? To be creative like that, to turn something that is now viewed in one way into something different just by your perseverance, by going against the flow. So I don't know what that means here, but it's sounds like the odd one out.
I don't mean to be an apologist for them, but I think it could be another case of it being a translation error, because it does fly in the face of pretty much all of the passages, doesn't it, in that creativity. Although, in a sense, it may be attributing it purely to human beings,
right,
rather than just nature itself.
I'm just laughing a bit, like not at you, but the way we solve things here when we don't know something is translation expert.
I know. that's why I kind of threw it out there that it's possible, but you know, yeah. I don't want to rely on that too much, because I might be seen as a bit too charitable on it. But I mean, it's not like it's something that's necessarily widely held anymore, because in its native, like, home of China, it's kind of forbidden now because of the anti-communist...
Because of European colonialism.
Exactly.
Ideological colonialism.
German colonialism.
Exactly.
To achieve naturalness, an individual needs to be one with the Tao. That's what it... That's a pretty fair summary of a lot of the things that we read earlier, and I don't think that's necessarily controversial in the canon of their beliefs.
I think they're just rehashing the point, because Tao is like the natural way, the natural kind of proceeding of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so to achieve naturalness is to be one with naturalness, yes. Sure.
It is kind of a bit of a circular statement, isn't it? And of course, it advocates for freeing oneself from selfishness and desire and appreciating a simpler life. And I think we touched on that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And to kind of end this, there's something known as the three treasures, which are compassion, moderation, and humility. Which
so those, like, the garden of virtues or something.
It's kind of some of the more important virtues that you might need to focus on, and they've more or less been translated as abstention from, like, in practice, I should say, these have been translated as abstention from aggressive war and capital punishment, and there being some kind of absolute simplicity of living and a refusal to assert active authority.
Mm-hmm.
So it's trying to say that there is some degree of natural order in man's actions, imposing some kind of false order subverts the true nature or the Tao of things.
So the last point, refusal to assert active authority, that would not be something like you in relation to other people or like in social interactions.
Yes.
It would be something relating to nature, right? Something like you saying, okay, there's some natural things that I can't do anything about, and I should be humble in the face of nature because I'm not mightier than nature.
Mm-hmm.
Like in that way.
Yeah,
not
but
necessarily saying, okay, if someone's stupid and they're talking about something they don't know about, you should not assert your authority if you know more about that, right? In like social scenarios, that's not about it.
I mean, it's one of those things where it's difficult to know the interpretation, but I can certainly see that. But I think the refusal to assert active authority is trying to say that there's it's kind of the humility point here, in that if you're asserting authority, you're not being humble, and you're not at one with the Tao, because you're saying that I have more authority and therefore my views are more important and I'm more important. And it's about seeking status here,
right?
And that is, I think, what it's looking at. But I think your interpretation as well is certainly, you know, perfectly reasonable as well.
Yeah, no, I was aiming at whether it's something social, which is probably not, because this is about the individual and about the individual's relation to nature and to the environment around them. It's not about if interpersonal relations or about social systems or anything like that, or morality when it comes to society. That's not the aim of it.
Well, it frames society as being almost a product, but not a product of nature, in that there are some aspects that can be natural, but in human beings' kind of ways, they subvert the natural Tao, right, as they might say.
So just to end it, what would you say is the kind of main takeaway that people can take from it? Because this is the first time I'm hearing about it properly. Mm-hmm. So, what would you say that people today can take away from it, as in kind of good advice for their personal lives, let's say?
I quite like that it focuses on just your being adaptable and being able to deal with the world without trying to impose too much on it yourself. Like, it's focusing almost on developing yourself rather than trying to change other people. And I think that's as a kind of stoic philosophical thing, but mentioned in a different way. And I'm also quite a big fan of the principle of Wu Wei, as I said, where it's looking at doing something that is in accordance with kind of the driving forces, not necessarily going along in a social sense with the status quo, but being able to read the kind of pull in the best way. It's difficult to articulate, because it's more of like it's something that you need to think about, and it's almost difficult to articulate it, if that makes any sense. I've just said the same thing
so
twice.
It's something that just people need to ponder, and then at some point it might click.
It's just more, it's
what,
more
what
of
it,
an approach,
what it means
yeah.
in their own personal lives.
Yeah, because I've been looking at Taoism for quite a while, and I've kind of toyed with some of the ideas just because it's been interesting, and I found that the kind of acceptance of the way things are, and kind of trying to limit your desires and just understand the way things are, is quite helpful for having a healthy mind. I don't know whether you see any virtues in Taoism. What do you think the main takeaways are for you?
I think you gave some good summary of what it's about. I think the focus on yourself and on building your own virtues, the kind of overlap that it has with Stoicism in that respect, is quite valuable. And the same good things that I have to say about Stoicism that I have with in the book club, and I think those apply to Taoism just as much, so it's quite good. Right, thank you for the introduction then.
That's quite all right. I hope you're feeling spiritually fulfilled now.
More than before. So, right, if you like this episode, visit lotusteachers.com, where we have all our stuff, all the contemplations episodes, and non-premium, premium, all kinds of content by us and by the rest of the team. And you can support us there as well by becoming a premium member. Well, thank you for watching, and see you next time.
Goodbye.